Not then. Me and him escaped, but we knew it was only a matter of time before they caught us. We were desperate, sitting on this stash, anxious to find a safe place for it before the cops closed in. We decided to split up. Johnny said he had the perfect place to hide the dough, but he figured it was better if only one of us knew. I'd have trusted him with my life. He swore he wouldn't lay a hand on it until we were both free to enjoy it. We went our separate ways, and by the time we got picked up, he was empty-handed. The cops beat the shit out of him, trying to find out where he'd hidden the take, but he never would say. Ended up he confessed to the crime, but he never told anyone what happened to the money. The irony was, it was the cops beating a confession out of him that got his conviction thrown out. Meantime, we both suspected Darryl was the one who blew the whistle on us. Like I said, after we were picked up, he testified against us in court. He swore up and down it wasn't him turned us in, trying to lay blame off on his brother Frank. Me and Johnny both got 25 years to life, but Johnny's conviction was overturned on appeal. He went home to his family while I'm sitting on my butt down in the U.S. Penitentiary in Atlanta, Georgia. Johnny went back later and removed enough from the stash to support himself and my ma, who's still back in Kentucky. He indicated her belly. That's what's left. Wait a minute. What makes you so sure it's 8 grand? Because he told me how much he took and what he spent since then. I did the math and figured out what the balance was. Where's the rest? Well, you know. I guess it's still where it was.
I stared at him.
I hope you're not going to tell me he died without revealing where he hid it.
Ray shrugged uneasily.
That's about it.
Chapter 12. Laura moaned and leaned forward as if she were on the verge of fainting. She tried to get her head down between her knees, but the bulk of her belly thwarted her. She leaned sideways against the bed pillows, pulling her knees up to her chest like a kid with a stomach ache.
"What's wrong?" Ray asked.
"Oh, God, I thought there'd be more. I thought you knew where it was," she whispered, beginning to weep again.
"I'm a hard-hearted little thing." I sat there wondering why crying is occasionally referred to as boo-hooing. I've never heard weepers use syllables even remotely related.
Ray moved over and sat beside her.
"Are you okay?"
She shook her head, rocking back and forth.
"Laura's fine," I said, bored. I was aware my tone was rude, but I knew what she was up to, and the girlish tears were annoying.
Ray rubbed her back, patting her shoulder in a series of ineffectual moves that, nevertheless, conveyed his compassion and concern.
"Hey, come on, that's okay. Just tell me what's wrong and I'll help. I promise. Don't cry."
"Excuse me, Ray, but you might want to be discreet. She's already busy double-crossing Gilbert, and she's supposedly in love with him. No telling what she does to people she doesn't give a shit about. Such as us, in case you missed the point," I said.
He looked at her, his brow furrowing.
"Is that right? Are you trying to get away from him?"
"By sticking it to us," I said caustically. Neither paid attention. I could have saved my breath. I handed her another wad of tissues, and she went through the whole nose-blowing routine again. She pressed a tissue to her eyes, damming the leak of tears. She launched into a fragmented explanation, but she couldn't quite manage it, and I was left to translate. I said, "She and Farley have joined forces. She's absconding with the money. This is just a guess on my part."
"You and Farley decided to pull a fast one?" he asked.
He was trying to sound calm, but I could tell he was seriously alarmed. He knew Gilbert well enough to guess the depth of trouble she was in. She nodded, tears spilling down her cheeks.
"Oh, Jesus, baby, I wish I'd known what you were up to. That's really not a good plan."
"I can't help it. Farley loves me. He said he'd help. He knows Gilbert beats me. I have to get away before he kills me dead."
"I understand, hon, but Gilbert is a lunatic. He's not going to like that. If he finds out, I hate to think what he'll do to get even. Come on now and let's talk. Maybe we can figure out a way to get you out of this."
I loved his use of the word "we." She sighed and sat up. Without the anchor of makeup, Her eyes looked like they'd shifted upward half an inch on her face. Her nose was stopped up, and her voice had dropped into a lower range. Her complexion was a mottled pink, and her hazel eyes seemed vivid against the dark red of her hair. The dark green corduroy jumper was hopelessly wrinkled, and the collar of her white turtleneck was streaked with foundation.
"I don't know what I was thinking of. I just had to get away."
She pulled her sleeve up.
"Look at that. I'm black and blue. I look worse than you do, only this has been going on for months."
"You have to get away from him, no question about that. Why'd you put up with it?"
"Because I didn't have any choice. I've been to shelters for battered women twice. I've hidden out with friends. Somehow he always finds me and brings me back. Now he makes sure I don't get close to anyone. I have to account for my every minute. He won't let me work. He won't let me have a nickel of my own. When I saw this coming up, I knew it was the only chance I'd ever have. I thought if I just had money, if I just had a way to get away from him..."
"Then take the money," he said. "It's yours. I couldn't believe it when Kinsey mentioned your name. You can ask her. I was stunned."
I wouldn't say stunned, but he did get real quiet.
"I had no idea you were involved in this," he went on.
"What difference would that have made?" she said, blowing her nose.
She seemed comforted by the fact that she'd surprised him somehow.
"I never would have come. I'd have let you have the $8,000. That's what I'm saying. It's yours. You take it. It's a gift."
"Forget that. I don't want it."
"I thought you said you didn't have any choice."
"Well, I do."
"Like what?"
"I don't know. I'll talk to Farley. We'll figure something out."
"Laura, don't be crazy. You were willing enough to take it before. Why not now?"
She turned on him harshly.
"I was willing to take it because I thought you betrayed your friends to get it. I thought it served you right. I didn't think you deserved to have it after what you did."
I was getting irritated by the melodrama, wishing they'd get on with it.
"Why don't you split the money and put an end to the argument?"
Ray shook his head.
"We don't have to split it. She can have the whole $8,000. I can always go back to Louisville and look for the rest."
"What are your chances of finding it after 40 years? I asked.
"Probably not that good, but I'd feel better knowing she had enough to get away."
"Ray, I said I'd handle it, and I will," she said.
"Why don't you let me do something?"
"It's too late."
He turned to me, his look bewildered.
"You talk to her. You tell her. I don't understand where she's coming from."
I said, "Here's the deal, Ray, and you can trust me on this. She wants your love. She wants approval. She wants you to beg forgiveness for what you've put her through all her life. She doesn't want to have anything else to do with you. She certainly doesn't want your help. She'd rather die first."
"Why?"
"Because she doesn't want to owe you anything," I snapped. He looked back at her.
"Is that right, what she said?"
"I don't know, I guess."
She paused to wipe her eyes and blow her nose again.
"I thought there'd be more. I thought you'd have millions. I was counting on it."
"There never was millions. Is that what Gilbert said?"
"How do I know? That's what he talked about for years," she said. "Maybe in his mind the money grew as time passed. The point is, $8,000 isn't going to get me any place. I pictured going to a foreign country, holding up someplace. But how long is $8,000 going to last?"
"It'll last long enough. Go to another state, change your name, find work. At least the $8,000 will help you get set up."
Laura's face was filled with despair.
"He'll find me. I know he will. I thought I had a chance with Farley, but now I'm worried sick."
"Where's Farley all this time?" I asked.
"He's in Santa Teresa with Gilbert. We didn't want him to get suspicious."
I raised my hand.
"Wait a minute. I'm confused. What was the original plan?"
"When I left Santa Teresa, I was supposed to fly to Palm Beach, Florida, where Gilbert had a buddy waiting. This is some pal he hired to keep an eye on me. Gilbert wanted to get the money out of California as soon as possible, but he thought we'd be too conspicuous if the three of us traveled together. Besides, he and Farley had to wait until their passports came through. I already had mine, so I was supposed to wait in Palm Beach and they'd join me. Later we'd fly to Rio."
"So Farley was left to deal with Gilbert."
"That's a bad idea. I don't even know Farley, and already I bet he's not smart enough to outfox Gilbert." "That's right, doll. Gilbert's certifiable, especially when he thinks he's been betrayed," Ray said to her. "Look at what he did to me. You think that's the end of it?"
"What am I supposed to do? It's done now. It's over. I took the money and ran. The minute I got here, I counted it. I thought I'd die when I found out how little there was.
I said, "Back up a step. When was Farley supposed to join you?"
"As soon as he could. They called the passport office, and the guy swore he'd put them in the mail. Farley knows where I am, and we made arrangements for him to call me from this payphone down the street."
"He never called you at all?"
"He called me once, this morning. He had to wait till Gilbert went out. When I told him about the $8,000, I could tell he was scared. He said he'd think of something and call me back in an hour."
Ray said, "You haven't heard from him?"
Laura shook her head.
I said, "But Gilbert must have known you never got off the plane in Palm Beach. Didn't his buddy call him right up to say you never showed?"
"Of course he did, but Gilbert doesn't have any idea where I am."
"Well, this is a very sophisticated plan," I said. "What about Farley? I'm sure Gilbert won't suspect him."
"You think he's figured it out?"
"Of course he has," Ray said. "He's waited 40 years to get his hands on this dough. Gilbert's a psychopath. He's so paranoid he's almost psychic. You're an amateur. You think he can't see right through you?"
"But Dallas is huge. He'll never find me," she said. "I paid the hotel in cash and I'm using an alias."
"Farley knows where you are."
"Well, sure, but I can trust him," she said.
Ray closed his eyes. "You better hit the road."
"But where would I go?"
"Who cares? Just get out of here."
"What about Farley? He won't know where I've gone."
"That's the point," I said. "I agree with Ray. You can't worry about him. You have to put as much distance as possible between you and Gilbert."
"Well, I'm not going to do it. I told Farley I'd be here, and I'm staying," she said.
I said, "Oh, boy."
"Gilbert isn't Superman. He doesn't have X-ray vision or anything like that."
"Yeah, right," I said.
I searched through my handbag until I found my airline ticket. I started opening drawers in the bed table looking for a telephone book.
"Well, gang, I don't know how you're going to resolve this little conflict, but I'm getting out of here."
"You're leaving us?" Ray said, startled. "What about Chester?"
"He fired me," I said. I found the yellow pages in a separate book that probably weighed 10 pounds. I lugged it out of the drawer and hauled it onto my lap, leafing through to the section marked Airlines. "Look, whatever you and Laura work out, that's between the two of you. I came to help recover the cash you're so busy giving away. I'm history. It makes no sense for me to stay here. If Chester doesn't like it, he can take it up with you. He's already so frosted, he probably won't pay my bill, which means I'm out of luck. I might as well go home, at least take charge of the situation to that extent."
I found the number for American and put my finger on the place while I picked up the receiver.
"But you can't just abandon us," Ray said.
"I wouldn't call it that," I said.
"What would you call it?"
"Ray, we're not joined at the hip. I came here on impulse, so I thought I'd go home the same way."
I tucked the phone in the crook of my neck and punched in the number for American Airlines. As soon as the number answered, I was put on terminal hold, while a mechanical voice assured me my business was valued beyond rubies. "Anyway, the money's stolen," I went on conversationally, "which is just one more reason I don't want to be involved in this."
"It's been 40 years since we cleaned out that vault," Ray protested. "The bank's out of business. Place went belly up back in 1949. Most customers are dead, so even if I wanted to play straight, who would I return the money to? The state of Kentucky? To what end? I spent my life in jail for that dough, and I earned every cent."
"It's still a crime," I said politely, not wanting to seem quarrelsome.
"What about the statute of limitations? Who's going to point a finger after all this time? Besides, I've been tried once, and I paid for my sins."
"Take it up with an attorney. You could be right. Just in case you're not, I think I'll steer clear," I said.
Laura was getting impatient. She apparently had no interest in our debate about jurisprudence. She leaned closer to me, hissing,
"I wish you'd get off the phone. What if Farley's trying to get through?"
I held a hand up like a traffic cop. The American Airlines ticket agent had just come on the line and introduced himself. I said, "Oh, hi, Brad. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I have an open-ended round-trip ticket from Santa Teresa, California, to Palm Beach, Florida, and I'd like to book the return. I'm in Dallas now, so I just need the Dallas-Santa Teresa leg."
"And what day would this be for?"
"As soon as possible. Today, if you can do it."
While Agent Brad and I conducted business, Ray and Laura seemed to be negotiating some sort of father-daughter truce. a financial ceasefire of sorts. Apparently, she was allowing him to gift her with a hotly contended $8,000. Dimly, I was aware that he was telling her he had to go down to his room on the 10th floor and pick up his bags. He wanted permission to leave his bags in her room until he could figure out where to go from here. Meanwhile, she began to pace, becoming more agitated as the agent and I tried to work out my itinerary. There were some alternate routes that would get me home by way of San Francisco or Los Angeles, using short hops for the final leg. Since this was Sunday, both direct flights were completely full, and his only suggestion was that I get myself on standby and hope for the best. He went ahead and waitlisted me on two flights, one nonstop, the other with a layover. The next flight was scheduled for departure at 2:22. I checked my watch. It was just past 12:30, and with the hotel shuttle or a taxi, I could probably get over to the airport in the next 35 to 40 minutes. Laura had crossed back to the bed table, where she stuck her face close to mine and mouthed, "Hang up!" She sat down on the other bed and began to unlace her high-top tennis shoes. I gave her a simpering smile as I began to wind up the conversation, reconfirming my notes about the flights in question. As I replaced the receiver in the cradle, I realized Ray was still in the room. "I thought you were going down to get your bags," I said. "I was afraid if I left you'd be gone when I got back." "That's a good bet. What's your inclination? Are you going to fly back to California?" "Nah, I don't think so. I think I'll hang out with Laura until she hears from Farley. As soon as her situation's settled, I'll take off for Louisville. I got a rental car downstairs. Meantime, if I lay low, the management will never know I'm here." "What about Chester? I hate to spoil all the fun, but half of the money belongs to him, you know."
"Says who?"
"You did. You said you were going to turn it over to him."
"I got news for you. He's screwed. I never really meant to cut him in on the deal."
"Ah, I guess I should have known that, right?"
"You're the one who pointed out how much I lie," he said.
"So I have to be the one to break the news to him? Thanks a lot, Ray. That sucks. What am I supposed to say?"
"You'll think of something. Plead ignorance. Make it up."
"Oh, right.
The guy's a butt anyway. I bet you never get reimbursed."
I said, "Your confidence in him is touching." Laura was still sulking, so we skipped the tender fare-thee-wells. I grabbed my shoulder bag, hoisted it, and backed out of the room. Then I headed for the fire stairs and made my way down 12 floors to the lobby. I took a taxi to the airport. I could have waited for the shuttle, which was free of charge, but the truth was, I didn't want to risk running into management. So far, I'd successfully outmaneuvered the hotel authorities, and I was just as happy leaving Texas without some kind of scrape with the law. I checked my wallet in the cab. Since I was on my way home, I figured I had sufficient cash for the journey, which is to say, plus or minus $35. I'd spent a little on incidentals, but in the main, I'd managed on the few resources I'd had. I'd still have to hassle with short-term parking fees when I got home. $7 a day for the 2 or 3 days I'd been gone. But in a pinch, I could call Henry and have him bring me the necessary cash. I hadn't formally checked out of my room, but the desk clerk had taken an impression of my credit card when I checked in, and I was sure the charges would appear on the next statement I received. Hotels aren't exactly dumb about these things. The cab dropped me off at the departure gates for American Airlines. I went into the terminal and crossed the lobby, checking the monitor for the departing flight numbers I'd been given. The first was scheduled to take off at 2:22, the second not until 6:10. The later flight wasn't even listed yet, but I found the gate number for the 2:22 departure. At least traveling without luggage simplified procedures to some extent. I bypassed the ticket counter and joined the line of passengers waiting to clear security. My handbag sailed through X-ray, but when I passed through the metal detector, there was a telltale shriek. I patted my pockets, which were empty of metal except for the paperclip and random change I'd used for the payphone. I backed up, dropped the items in a plastic dish. I tried again. The shrieking seemed to rise to an accusatory pitch. I could tell the security sorceress was about to douse my body with her divining rod when I remembered the key I'd stitched into my shoulder pad. "Hang on a minute, I got it." To the annoyance of those behind me, I backed up again, peeled off my blazer, and laid it on the moving belt. This time I made it through. I have expected to be quizzed about the key stitched into the shoulder seam, but no one said a word. Those people probably saw things much stranger any given day of the week. I collected my shoulder bag and the blazer and headed for the gate. I pulled my ticket from my handbag and presented it to the gate agent, explaining my situation. The flight was completely booked, and she didn't seem that optimistic about my getting a seat. I sat in the waiting area while other passengers checked in. Apparently, several of us were angling for the same flight, which I suspected was already desperately oversold. I eyed the competition, some of whom looked like those quarrelsome types who raise hell when anything goes wrong. I might have tried it myself if I'd thought it would do any good. As far as I can tell, there are only so many seats. The plane is either flight-worthy or it's not. Between mechanical matters and air traffic control, either you fly or you don't. I've never heard of an airline yet that proceeded on the basis of noisy passenger complaints. So why bitch and moan? I pulled out my paperback romance novel and began to read. As flight time approached, the passengers were boarded in orderly rows, from the rear to the front, with the privilege taking precedence. Finally, six names were called from the standby list, and none of them were mine. Oh, well. The gate agent sent me an apologetic smile, but there was nothing to be done. She swore she'd put me at the head of the list for the next flight out. In the meantime, I had close to 4 hours to kill. From what I gathered, the flight crews made 2 daily loops from Dallas to Santa Teresa, in and out of the same gate, 7 days a week. All I had to do was find a way to occupy my time and then present myself back here before the boarding process began again. With luck, I'd get a seat and be homeward bound. Without luck, I'd be stuck in Dallas until 2 o'clock Monday afternoon. I walked 1 mile in the terminal corridor just to stretch my legs. I took advantage of the ladies' room, where I was very ladylike. As I emerged and turned right, I passed the airport equivalent of an outdoor cafe, tables separated from the terminal corridor by a low wrought iron fence and fake plants. The small bar offered the usual wines, beers, and exotic mixed drinks, while under glass, assorted fresh seafoods were packed on a mound of crushed ice. I hadn't eaten lunch, so I ordered a beer and a plate of fresh shrimp, which came with cocktail sauce, oyster crackers, and lemon wedges. I peeled and sauced my shrimp, doing a little people-watching to amuse myself while I ate. When I finished, I wandered back to the gate. I took a seat by the window. I read my book, intermittently watching airplanes land and take off. Occasionally I nodded off, but the seats weren't really built for any serious sleep. By hook or by crook, I managed to carve the 4 hours down to slightly more than 1. Toward the end of the time allotted, I made a trip to the newsstand and picked up the local paper. I returned to the gate at 5, just as the flight from Santa Teresa was arriving. I checked with one of the gate agents and made sure my name was on the standby list. Most seats in the waiting area were now full, so I leaned against a column and scanned the paper. The jetway door had been opened, and the first-class passengers began to file out, looking ever so much fresher than the travelers behind them. The coach passengers came next, eyes straying across the crowd to find the people who'd come to meet them. Many joyous reunions. Grandmothers swept little children into their arms. A soldier hugged his sweetheart. Husbands and wives exchanged obligatory busses. 2 teenagers with a cluster of helium balloons began to squeal at the sight of a sheepish-looking young guy coming down the jetway. Altogether, it was a very pleasant way to spend a few minutes, and I found myself happily distracted from the grim array of the day's news in the paper. I was just in the process of turning to the funnies when the last smattering of passengers straggled off the plane. It was the Stetson that caught my attention. I averted my gaze, glancing up only fleetingly as Gilbert walked by. Chapter 13. I glanced at my watch. My plane probably wouldn't board for another 20 to 30 minutes. The cleaning crew would have to sweep through, collecting discarded newspapers, wadded tissues, earphones, and forgotten items. I laid my paper aside and followed Gilbert, whose Stetson, pale blue denim jacket, and cowboy boots made him easy to keep an eye on. He had to be much closer to Ray's age than I'd realized on first glance. I'd pegged him in his late 50s, but he was probably 62, 63, somewhere in there. I couldn't figure out what Laura had seen in him in the first place, unless she was quite literally looking for a father. Whatever the appeal, the sexual chemistry must have been intertwined with his brutality. Too many women mistake a man's hostility for wit, and his silence for depth. He pushed through revolving doors to the same baggage claim area I'd entered early Saturday. The area was crowded and afforded me natural cover. While Gilbert waited for the bags, I scanned the area for a payphone. There were probably some around the corner, but I didn't want to let him out of my sight. I moved over to the hotel directory and found the number for the Desert Castle. The telephone system linked all the hotels that serviced the airport, but did not admit of outside calls beyond that. I pulled a pen and paper from my bag as the line was ringing. "Desert Castle," a woman said, picking up on the other end. "Hi, I'm over at the airport. Can you give me the hotel operator?" "No, ma'am. I'm not tied into the hotel switchboard. This is a separate facility." "Well, can you give me the phone number over there?" "Yes, ma'am. You want reservations, sales, or catering?" "Just give me the main number." She recited the number, which I dutifully noted. I'd find a payphone as soon as opportunity allowed. Behind me, a bell finally sounded, mimicking a burglar alarm. The overlapping metal segments of the carousel gave a lurch and began to move in a counterclockwise direction. Two suitcases came around the bend, then a third and a fourth as the conveyor brought them up from below. The waiting passengers crowded forward, angling for position as the bags tumbled down the incline and began their slow journey on the circular metal track. While Gilbert watched for his luggage, I retrieved the two quarters from my blazer pocket, playing with them nervously while I waited to see what he would do. He retrieved a soft-sided suitcase from the carousel and pushed through the crowd, moving toward the corridor. I turned away long before he passed, aware that any sudden movement might attract his attention. Approaching the escalator, he stepped to one side and squatted while he unzipped his suitcase and removed a sizable handgun to which he affixed a silencer. Several people glanced down and saw what he was doing, but went about their business as though it were no big deal. Clearly to them, he didn't look like the sort of fellow who would cut loose in a crowd, mowing down everyone within range of him. He tucked the gun in his belt and pulled his denim jacket over it. He adjusted his Stetson, re-zipped his suitcase, and proceeded in a leisurely manner to the car rental desk. He must not have had advance reservations, because I saw him inquire at Budget and then move to Avis. I spotted a bank of telephones and found the only free instrument among the five. I jammed a quarter in the slot and dialed the number for the Desert Castle. I turned, checking the immediate area, but there was no sign of airport security. "Desert Castle, how may I direct your call?" "Could you ring Laura Hudson's room? She's in 1236, I said. Laura's line was busy. I kept waiting for the operator to cut back in, but she had apparently quit her job and gone to work for someone in another state. I depressed the plunger and started over, using my last precious quarter to try the hotel again. "Desert Castle, how may I direct your call?" "Hi, I'm trying to reach Laura Hudson in 1236, but her line is busy. Can you tell me if Ray Rawson is still registered there?" "Just a moment, please," she clicked out. Dead silence. She clicked back in. "Yes, ma'am. Would you like me to ring his room?" "Yes, but if he doesn't answer, would you come back on the line for me?" "Certainly." The number rang in Ray's room 15 times before she cut back in. "Mr. Rawson doesn't answer. Would you care to leave a message?" "Is there any way to page him instead?" "No, ma'am, I'm sorry. Was there anything else I could help you with?" "I don't think so." "Oh, yes, wait a minute. Could you connect me with the manager?" She'd hung up before I'd even finished the sentence. By now I had so much adrenaline pumping through me, I could hardly breathe. Gilbert Hayes was standing at the Avis counter filling out the paperwork. He seemed to be consulting one of those multicolored one-sheet maps of the vicinity, the desk clerk leaning over helpfully, pointing out his route. I took the escalator to the street. Outside, lights had come on, only partially dispelling the gloom of the pickup area. A limousine pulled to the curb in front of me, the uniformed white driver coming around to the door on the passenger side to assist a silver-haired couple as they emerged. The woman wore the fur of some beast I'd never seen. She looked around uneasily, as though she were accustomed to warding off insults. The driver removed their luggage from the trunk. I searched the area, looking for airport police. Light and shadow played across the concrete in patterns as repetitious as a stencil. A wind tunnel had been created by the building's construction, and a diesel-scented gale blew through, generated by the constant rush of passing traffic. I didn't see any of the vans from the hotel. I didn't see a cab stand or any passing taxis. Gilbert had probably already been given the keys to his rental car. He'd be coming out the door behind me, searching out the waiting area for the shuttle that would take him to the slot where his vehicle was waiting. Or perhaps, far worse, the rental car had been left in the parking garage just across the way, in which case he only had to cross the street. My gaze settled on the limousine. The driver had received his tip, touched his cap, closed the limo door on the rear passenger side. He circled the back end of the vehicle, heading for the driver's side, where he opened the door and slid behind the wheel. I began to rap frantically on the front passenger side window. The glass was tinted so darkly I couldn't see in at all. The window was lowered with a whir. The driver looked across at me, his expression neutral. He was in his 30s, with a round face, sparsely growing red hair combed straight back from the crown. Along the edges of his ears, I could see where his hat had rested. I leaned in slightly, handing him my wallet with my California driver's license and my private investigator's license showing. I said, "Please listen very carefully. I need help. I'm a private investigator from Santa Teresa, California. Somewhere behind me there's a guy with a gun who's here in Dallas to kill a couple of friends of mine. I need to get to the Desert Castle. Do you know where that is?" He took my wallet gingerly, like a cat who deigns to accept a treat from an unfamiliar hand. "I know the Desert Castle." He looked at the picture on my driver's license. I could see him take in the information on my private investigator's license. He began to leaf through some of my other identification cards. He handed my wallet back, and then simply sat and stared at me. He popped the lock up and then reached for the keys in the ignition. I opened the passenger door and got in. The limo pulled away from the curb as silently as a train easing out of a station. The seats were gray leather, and the dashboard was a burled walnut, so shiny it looked like plastic. Just at my left knee was a handset for the car phone. "Mind if I use that to call the cops?" I asked.
"Be my guest."
I dialed 911 and explained the situation to the emergency dispatcher, who asked for my approximate location and said she'd have a county sheriff's deputy meet us at the Desert Castle. I tried the hotel again, but I couldn't get the operator to pick up at all. We circled the airport and headed off toward open country. It was fully dark by now. The land seemed vast and flat. The headlights illuminated long stretches of green, with an occasional monolithic office building jutting up on the horizon. Lighted billboards appeared like a series of flashcards. Where we crested a rise, I could see the sweep of intersecting highways defined by the lights from fast-moving traffic. Anxiety buzzed and sizzled in my gut like defective neon, outlining vital organs.
"What's your name?" I asked. If I didn't talk, I'd go mad. "Nathaniel."
"How'd you get into this?"
"It's just a way to pick up money until I finish my novel."
His tone was glum. I said, "Ah."
"I used to live in Southern California. I was hoping to get a screenplay launched. So I moved out to Hollywood and worked for this actress who played the zany sister-in-law on a sitcom about a waitress with five adorable kids. Show only lasted a couple seasons, but she was raking it in. I think most of the money went up her nose, to tell you the truth. I drove her to the studio and back every day and washed her car and things like that. Anyway, she told me if I came up with an idea for a film, she'd have me pitch it to her agent and maybe she could help me break in. So I get this idea about this wacko mother-daughter relationship where the girl dies of cancer. I tell her about it, and she says she'll see what she can do. Next thing I know, I go to a movie theater on Westwood Boulevard and see this movie about some girl dies of cancer. Can you believe that? What's her name? Shirley MacLaine and that other one. Deborah Winger. There it was. I should have had it registered with the Guild, only nobody mentioned that. Thanks a lot, gang.
I looked over at him. You came up with the storyline for Terms of Endearment?
Not the storyline per se, but the basic concept. My chick didn't get married and have all them kids. You want my opinion, that was over the top.
Wasn't Terms of Endearment a Larry McMurtry book?
He shook his head, sighing. My point exactly. Where do you think he got it?
What about the astronaut, the Jack Nicholson part?
I didn't fool with that, and personally, I didn't think it worked all that well. Later, I found out this actress had the same agent used to be partners with Shirley MacLaine's agent way back when. That's the way Hollywood works. Real incestuous. The whole deal kind of soured me, to tell you the truth. I never saw a dime, and when I asked her about it, she gave me this look like she doesn't even know what I'm talking about. I kicked the shit out of her town car and set fire to the thing.
Really? He slid a look in my direction.
You probably have a lot of interesting experiences in your line of work.
I don't. It's mostly paperwork.
Same here. People think I must know all these rock stars. Closest I ever came was once I drove Sonny Bono to his hotel. Privacy window was rolled up the whole time, which kind of pissed me off. Like I'm going to call the National Enquirer if he sticks his hand up some chick's skirt.
I torqued around in my seat. The privacy window was rolled down, and I peered the length of the limousine's interior through the darkly tinted rear window. There was a moving stream of cars behind us, all barreling down the highway at breakneck speeds. We turned off the main highway into the commercial industrial park. In the distance, I saw the desert castle appear, red neon glowing hotly against the night sky. I watched while the red drained out of the letters and filled up again. The ratio of the lighted rooms to dark created an irregular checkerboard effect, with the proliferation of black squares suggesting 15% occupancy. Only a smattering of cars now followed in our wake. As this was Sunday evening, it was hard to believe that any were heading for the offices across the way. We passed the miniature oasis with its phony stone tower, the structure probably only slightly taller than I. Nathaniel swung the limo into the circular hotel entranceway, pulling to a smooth stop beneath the portico. I felt anxiety stir, wondering if he expected payment for his services.
I don't have enough to tip you. I'm really sorry about that.
That's cool. He handed me his business card. You have any ideas for a female-type Sam Spade film? We could maybe collaborate. Chicks kicking shit and stuff like that.
I'll give it some thought. I really appreciate your help.
I got out and closed the door behind me, aware that the limo was already pulling away. There was no sign of the sheriff's deputy, but Dallas County is a big place, and it hadn't been that long since I'd called. I moved toward the revolving doors, half trotting in my haste. The lobby was crowded with the departing track team, kids in shorts, jeans, and matching satin jackets with their school mascot stitched across the back. All of them wore running shoes that made their feet look enormous and reduced their pre-adolescent legs to sticks. Gym bags and oversized canvas duffels had been lined up in random clusters, while the kids themselves milled around, engaged in various forms of horseplay. Some of the girls sat on the floor, using the baggage for backrests. One kid had had his T-shirt peeled off against his will, and he was in the process of wrestling with two teammates to get it back. The laughter had a nervous edge to it. Really, the boys reminded me of puppies playing tug-of-war with an old sock. The supervising adult seemed to take all this energy for granted, probably hoping the kids would be exhausted by the time they got on the bus. I moved past them to the elevators and pushed the up button. The elevator doors down the line opened, and I got on, glancing back across the lobby to see if there was any sign of Gilbert. A silver Trailways bus was just pulling up in front, motor growling while the door opened with a sound of flatulence. I pushed 12 and the elevator door slid shut.
Once on Laura's floor, I trotted down the hall and knocked on 1236. I was murmuring to myself, snapping my fingers rapidly. Come on, come on, come on. Laura answered the door, slightly taken aback when she saw me.
What are you doing here? I thought you left.
Where's Ray? I gotta talk to him.
He's asleep. He's right here. What's wrong?
I saw Gilbert at the airport. He's on his way over with a gun. Get Ray, grab your things, and let's get out of here.
Oh, no.
She seemed to pale at the news, one hand going to her mouth.
What's going on?
Ray said from behind her. He was already on his feet, tucking his shirt in as he approached. I moved into the room, and Laura closed the door behind me. She leaned against the wall, her eyes momentarily closing in dread. I slid the security chain across the track. I said, Go. The word seemed to get her mobilized. Laura moved toward the closet, hauling out her raincoat and the duffel.
What's happening? Ray said, looking from one of us to the other.
She saw Gilbert. He's got a gun and he's on his way. You should have called instead of coming all the way back, she said reprovingly.
She unzipped the duffel and began to sweep cosmetics off the counter into the bag. I did call. The line was busy.
I was talking to room service. We had to eat, she said.
Ladies, would you quit bickering and let's move?
I am.
She began to snatch up her nightie, slippers, dirty underwear. She laid her denim dress across the back of the chair, and she grabbed that, holding it against her chest so she could fold it in thirds and then in half again. Ray took it, rolled it into a ball, and jammed it in the duffel, which he zipped shut. I saw his two suitcases stacked up to the left of the door. I grabbed the smaller one and watched while he picked up the other.
Take what's essential and dump the rest, I said. You have a car?
Out in the lot.
Will Gilbert try the elevator or the stairs?
Who knows?
I said, Look, I think you two should go the back way. Gilbert's bound to waste time knocking on the door up here. He may try Ray's room, too, if it occurs to him you're here. Give me the car keys and tell me where you're parked.
What are we supposed to do in the meantime? Laura asked.
Wait for me out by that fake stone tower by the drive. I'll get the car and swing around to pick you up. He doesn't know me, so if we pass in the hall, he won't think anything of it. Ray gave me a hasty description of the car and its approximate location.
End of Disc 5. Disc 6.
Ray gave me a hasty description of the car and its approximate location. The plastic tag on the key listed the license plate number, so I was reasonably certain I could find it without trouble. I handed Ray the bag while Laura did a quick survey, making sure she hadn't left anything critical. I took the chain off the hook and peered into the corridor both ways, motioning to the two of them. Ray and Laura took a right, heading for the fire stairs at the end of the hall. I moved to the left toward the elevators. The elevator felt like it was descending at half speed. I watched the lighted floor numbers move from right to left, counting backward in slow motion. When the elevator reached the lobby, there was the customary ping, and then the door slid open. Gilbert was standing 2 feet away, waiting to get on. For a moment, our eyes locked and held. His were bottomless, dark holes. I let my gaze drift away casually as I passed, moving off to the right as if on ordinary hotel business. Behind me, the door slid shut. I checked the lobby for some sign of the county sheriff's deputy. No sign of law enforcement. I picked up my pace, glancing back automatically at the floor indicator lights. The elevator should have been going up. Instead, the light remained frozen where it was. I heard a ping, and the elevator door slid open. Gilbert emerged. He stood on the wide expanse of carpeting just outside the elevators, staring in my direction. Crooks and cops often function with a heightened sense of awareness, a clarity of perception born of adrenaline. Their work, and just as often their lives, depend on acumen. Gilbert was apparently a person who registered reality with uncanny accuracy. Something in his expression told me he remembered my face from our one brief encounter at the Santa Teresa airport. How he put me together with Laura Huckabee, I'll never know. The moment was electric, recognition arcing between us like a lightning bolt. I kept my pace at normal as I turned the corner. I passed the entrance to the coffee shop and turned right again into a short corridor with 3 doors leading off it. One blank, one marked, authorized personnel only,
one marked maintenance. The minute I was out of Gilbert's visual range, I broke into a run, my shoulder bag thumping against my hip. I slammed through the unmarked door and found myself in a barren back hallway I hadn't seen before. The concrete floor and bare concrete walls curved around to the left. The walls extended upward into the fading light until the upper reaches disappeared into darkness. There was no ceiling in view, but a series of thick ropes and chains hung motionless among the shadows. I passed empty racks of serving trays, wooden pallets packed with glassware, stacks of linen tablecloths, carts filled with plates in assorted sizes. Bank after bank of stacked chairs lined the walls, narrowing the passage in places. My footsteps chunked softly, the sound blunted by the rubber tread on my Reeboks. I had to guess that this was a service corridor, bordering a banquet room, a circle within a circle with access to freight elevators and the kitchens one floor down. A short flight of stairs led upward. I grabbed the handrail and pulled myself along, skipping steps as I ran. The shoulder bag made me feel like I was dragging an anchor, but I couldn't part with it. At the top, the corridor continued. Here, stacked against the walls, were various seasonal decorations. Christmas angels, artificial spruce trees, two enormous interlocking comedy-tragedy masks. Gilded wooden putti and cupids, enormous valentine hearts pierced with golden arrows. A grove of silk ficus suggested a small interior forest bereft of birds and other wildlife. Behind me, I heard a door hinge squeak. I picked up my pace, following the deserted corridor. A metal ladder that looked like an interior fire escape scaled its way up the wall on my left. I let my eye take the journey first, uncertain what was up there. I glanced back, dimly aware that someone was coming along the corridor behind me. I grabbed the first rung and headed up, Reeboks tinking as I climbed. I paused at the top, which was some 20 feet up. A steel catwalk stretched out along the wall ahead of me. I was close enough to the ceiling to reach up and touch it. The catwalk itself was less than 3 feet wide. Below me, through the yawning shadows, the floor looked like a flat, still river of concrete. The only thing that kept me from falling was a chain rail supported by metal uprights. As usual, when confronted with heights, my greatest fear was the irresistible urge to fling myself off. I slowed to a creeping pace, hugging the wall. I didn't dare go any faster for fear the catwalk itself would be loosened from the wall-mounted brackets that secured it. I didn't think I could be seen, cloaked as I was by the darkness up here, but the corridor itself functioned like an echo chamber, announcing my presence. Somewhere behind me, I heard hard heels on concrete, a running step that slowed suddenly to a stealthier pace. I sank to my hands and knees and crawled forward with care, the metal surface beneath me buckling and trembling. I had to hump my shoulder bag in front of me as I progressed. I was trying not to call attention to myself, but the rickety catwalk rattled and danced beneath my weight. I spotted a small wooden door in the wall. With infinite care, I eased the latch back and opened it. Before me was a dimly lighted, musty passageway about 6 feet high, rimmed along the top with a continuous series of hand-cranked window panels, some of which were standing open, admitting artificial light. The floor of the passageway was carpeted and smelled of dust motes. I felt my way forward, still on hands and knees, now hauling the bag after me. The silence was punctuated only by the sound of my ragged breathing. I turned and eased the door shut behind me, then crept over to the nearest window and lifted myself gingerly to my feet. Below was one of those vast meeting rooms meant for banquets and large assemblages. An endless pattern of fleur-de-lis proceeded across the carpeting, steel blue on a ground of gray. A series of sliding doors could be drawn across the space at the midway point, effectively dividing the one room into two. 8 evenly spaced chandeliers hung like clusters of icicles, throwing out a flat light. Around the periphery, up near the ceiling where I was, the continuous rim of mirrored glass windows concealed the space where I hid. I peered back across my shoulder. Through the gloom now I could see the looming apparatus for a lighting system that must have been called into play on special occasions, floods and spots with various colored gels. By the light coming through the windows, I hunkered down and opened my bag, taking out my wallet. I removed my driver's license, PI license and other identification, including cash and credit cards, all of which I stuffed in the pockets of my blazer in haste. I snagged Ray's car keys, my birth control pills, the key picks, and my Swiss Army knife, cursing the fact that women's suit jackets aren't constructed with an interior breast pocket. I plucked out my toothbrush and tucked it in with the other items. My blazer pockets were bulging, but I couldn't help myself. In a pinch, I'm willing to suffer tatty underpants, but not unbrushed teeth. I became aware that the floor beneath me was vibrating ever so slightly. In California, I'd assume that a 2.2-magnitude Tembler was lapping through the earth like an ocean wave. I whipped my head around toward the door. I set my bag aside, sank to a hunkering position, and duck-walked across the narrow passage. I felt the perimeter of the door, fingers reaching for the latch bolt on my side. On the far side of the wall, someone was making shaky progress, just as I had along the catwalk. I found the latch and ever so silently pushed the bolt through the eye. I still had my hand on the bolt when the door gave a vicious rattle. Someone on the far side was testing the latch. A spurt of fear traveled through me, triggering tears that leapt into my eyes. I pressed my hand against my mouth to suppress a gasp. The door was chattering against the lock so hard I thought it would give way, leaving me exposed to view. Silence. Then the floor began to shake again as Gilbert moved away. I glanced to my left, following his progress as he continued down the catwalk. I prayed there wasn't another wooden door farther down the line. He must have reached a dead end because a few minutes later I felt the floor vibrate with his weight as he passed me again, this time heading toward the ladder leading down to the corridor. I waited until I thought I was safe. It felt like an eternity, but was probably close to 15 minutes. Then I reached out carefully and pushed the bolt back. I bent my head to listen, hearing nothing. When I opened the door, the fire alarm went off. Chapter 14. My opening of the door and the clanging were so closely connected, I thought Gilbert had booby-trapped the door somehow. The overhead sprinklers came on in a torrent of internal rain. The distant scent of smoke assailed me, as unmistakable as the lingering trail of perfume when a woman passes. I moved back to the windows overlooking the banquet room. There was no sign of flames, no billowing black smoke. The room looked empty, bright, and blank. Someone began to make an announcement on the public address system, giving instructions or advice about what hotel guests were supposed to do. All I could hear was the muffled urgency of the proclamation. The exact location of the fire was anybody's guess. The lights went out, plunging me into total darkness. I felt my way over to the wooden door, crawling through, unencumbered by worldly possessions. I was being stripped down to the essentials, feeling light and free, and at the same time anxious. My handbag was a talisman, as comforting as a security blanket. Its bulk and heft were familiar, its contents assurance that certain totem items were always within reach. The bag had served as both pillow and weapon. It felt odd to be shed of it, but I knew it had to be. Blindly, I measured the width of the catwalk, sensing the cavernous abyss on my left, where my hand plunged suddenly into nothingness. The entire area was pitch black, but I could hear an ominous pop and crackling noise. A blistering wind blew, sending a shower of sparks in my direction. I could smell hot, dry wood, undercut by the acrid odor of petroleum-based products, changing chemical states. I inched my way forward. Ahead, I could now discern a soft reddish glow, defining the wall where the corridor curved left. A long finger of smoke curled around the corner toward me. If the fire caught me on the catwalk, it would probably sweep right past. But the rising cloud of toxic fumes would snuff me out as effectively as the flames. While the water from the sprinkler system hissed steadily, it seemed to have no effect on the fire that I could see. The play of tawny light on the walls began to expand and dance, pushing fine ash and black smoke ahead of it, gobbling up all the available oxygen. The metal catwalk was slippery, the chain railing swinging wildly as I propelled myself onward. The public address system came to life again. The same announcement was repeated, a garbled blend of consonants. I reached the top of the ladder. I was afraid to turn my back on the encroaching fire, but I had no choice. With my right foot, I felt for the first rung, gauging the distance as I moved down from rung to rung. I began descending with care, my hands sliding on the wet metal side rail. Hanging lengths of chain turned gold in the light, sparks flying up, winking out like intermittent fireflies on a hot summer night. By now the fire was providing sufficient illumination to see the air turn gray as smoke accumulated. I reached the bottom of the ladder and moved to my left. The fire was heating the air to an uncomfortable degree. I could hear a snapping sound, glass shattering, the merry rustle of destruction as the flames roared toward me. Despite the liberal use of concrete, the hotel had sufficient combustible material to feed the swiftly spreading blaze. I heard the dull boom of thunder as something behind me gave way and collapsed. This entire portion of the hotel had apparently been engulfed. I spotted a door on my left. I tried the knob, which was cool to the touch. I turned it and pushed through, spilling abruptly into a second-floor hall. Here the air was much cooler. The rainbirds in the ceiling showered the deserted corridor with irregular sprays. I was getting used to the dark, which now seemed less dense, a chalky gloom instead of the impenetrable black of the inner corridor. The carpet was saturated, slapping wetly beneath my feet as I stumbled down the darkened hallway. Afraid to trust my eyes, I held my arms out stiffly, waving my hands in front of me like a game of blind man's buff. The fire alarm continued its monotonous clanging, a secondary horn bleating gutturally. In a submarine movie, we'd be diving by now. I felt my way across another doorframe. Again, the knob seemed cool to the touch, suggesting that, for the time being, the fire wasn't raging on the other side. I turned the knob, pushing the door open in front of me. I found myself on the fire stairs, which I knew intimately by now. I went down through the blackness, reassured by the familiarity of the stairwell. The air was cold and smelled clean. When I reached the main floor, the emergency generators kicked in, and briefly lights flickered back to life. The corridor was deserted, doors closed. Here there was no sign of movement, no hint of smoke, the sprinkler system muffled. Every public room I passed was empty of guests. I found a fire door marked emergency exit with a big flexible bar across the center, the surface posted with warnings. As I pushed through the door, yet another siren began to howl behind me. I walked rapidly, without a backward glance, until I reached the side lot where Ray's rental car was parked. The fire engines were pulled up at the hotel entrance, where clusters of evacuated hotel guests were milling about. The night sky was a fervent yellow, choked by columns of white smoke where the fire and the water from the hoses came into contact. At the side of the building, two sprays of water crossed in midair like a pair of Klieg lights. Parts of the hotel were completely engulfed by fire, glass crashing, flames curling up as a cloud of black smoke rolled out. The portion of the driveway that I could see was blocked by the fire trucks and fire hoses, emergency vehicles flashing strobes of amber light. Overhead, a helicopter hovered where a local news team was taking pictures, reporting live at the scene. I found Ray's car keys in my blazer pocket and let myself into his rental. I started the engine and flipped the heater on. My clothes were soaked, water still trickling down my face from the hair plastered to my head. I knew I smelled of smoke, wet wool, wet denim, and damp socks. The Texas night was cold, and I could feel myself being overtaken by a bone-deep shivering. I let the engine warm up. The car was a full-size Ford, a four-door automatic, white with a red interior. I threw the gears into reverse and backed out of the lot, scanning the empty parking lot for signs of Gilbert. I left my headlights off as I eased along the perimeter of the lot toward the far side. The exit was blocked by a cop with a flashlight, forcing traffic to detour. I picked a spot along a row of hedges and drove across the curb, forcing the car through the thickly growing bushes. I emerged on the access road about 100 yards beyond the roadblock. The officer probably saw me, but there was not much he could do. He had his hands full directing all the carloads of rubberneckers. I turned right on the road leading back to the main highway. As I passed the miniature stone castle, I slowed, giving my horn a quick beep. Ray and Laura emerged hurriedly from the shadows, Ray toting the three bags loaded down like a pack mule. Laura still wore the phony harness in front, the $8,000 borne against her belly like an infant. The illusion of pregnancy was so convincing that Ray hovered protectively. I heard the trunk pop open, followed by the thumping impact as Ray flung the bags in the back and banged the lid down. He opened the door on the passenger side front and slid onto the seat next to me, while Laura let herself in the back. I put my foot on the gas and took off with a chirp, anxious to put distance between us and the enemy. Ray said,
"We didn't think you'd show. We were just about to take off on foot."
He turned around, peering through the rear window at the burning hotel behind us.
"Gilbert did that?"
"One assumes," I said.
"Of course he did," Laura said peevishly. "He was probably waiting out front, ready to pick us off as we came through the revolving doors."
I glanced at her in the rearview mirror. Like Ray, she had turned to peer back at the fire. The glow on the horizon varied from blood red to salmon, a white cloud billowing where the water from the fire hoses turned to steam.
"It's a hell of a blaze. How'd he manage it without accelerants?"
"Give him credit. The guy's resourceful. He's quick on his feet, and he's good at improvisation," she said.
Ray turned to face forward, reaching for his seatbelt, which he snapped into place. I saw